say all men are created equal, but you look at me and you look at Small Joe, and you can see that statement is not true. See, normally if you go one-on-one with another wrestler, you got a 50-50 chance of winning. But I'm a genetic freak, and I'm not normal. So you got a 25% at best at beating me. And then you add Kurt Angle to the mix, your chances of winning drastically go down. See, the three-way at Sacrifice, you got a 33 1/3 chance of winning. But I got a 66 2/3 chance of winning because Kurt Angle knows he can't beat me, and he's not even going to try. So, Samoa Joe, you take your 33 1/3 chance minus my 25% chance, and you got an 8 1/3 chance of winning. But then you take my 75% chance of winning. If we used to go one-on-one and then add 66 2/3%, I got 141 2/3 chance of winning. The numbers don't lie, and they spell disaster for you at Sacrifice.
Hey, guys, this is Jay Lethal, and you're listening to The Sound Off with The Sallow Monster.
The Sallow Monster sounds off.
Hulk Hogan has definitely been that rocket fuel that TNA needed.
This doesn't make any sense.
Your title belt is made of leather. You're not a real vegan.
I'm fat. Two of them been beat up properly. Woo!
This is episode 287 of the Sallow Monster Sounds Off, exclusively on the SallowMonster.com, Stitcher Radio on Demand, and in iTunes. I am the Sallow Monster. It is Sunday, August 11th, 2013. You heard the voice of one Jay Lethal there earlier at the beginning of the show, and the reason I played that is because it was 100 episodes ago on episode 187 that I interviewed Jay Lethal. So if you want to go back in the archives and check it out, you can find it on thesallowmonster.com in the archives. We talked about his time in ROH. I believe at the time he was the Ring of Honor television champion when we spoke. His time in TNA as part of the X Division, doing the Black Machismo gimmick, getting to work with Ric Flair. He had some really great moments in TNA. To this day, I'm not really sure why they let him go, nor am I sure that he knows why they let him go, but come on. This is TNA here. They've made some questionable personnel decisions over time. I also want to thank two of our listeners, Scott and Donde, here at the beginning of the show for their very generous PayPal donations. It really is the best way to show your support for the show, and your support certainly does not go unappreciated. So if you want to make a PayPal donation, you can go on thesallowmonster.com, scroll down just a little bit. You'll see a little box on the right-hand side. You can donate whatever you want. So I just wanted to give a shout-out to those two for their donations. A lot of news to get to this week. We're going to start things out with one of the bigger stories, which is Sheamus out for up to 6 months with a shoulder injury. WWE.com broke the news on Tuesday that Sheamus would be undergoing shoulder surgery this past week to repair a torn labrum suffered during the Money in the Bank All-Stars match last month. He's expected to miss anywhere from 4 to 6 months. And the injury happened when he got thrown off the top rope through one of the ladders at ringside. He obviously did not know it at that time. He was wrestling for several more weeks after that. Aggravated the injury further. They were on the tour of South Africa recently. He noticed he was having limited range of motion in his left shoulder. He was having some sharp pains down his arm, which is never a good sign. So doctors hope the surgery will give him the best chance of recovery and the best shot at a normally functioning shoulder. That was what they said in the WWE.com story, and that language I think is kind of concerning. No? They hope that it allows him to have a normal shoulder again? Shoulder injuries are the worst. I know people, non-athletes granted, but still, I know people who have fallen and broken their shoulders, and some of them still to this day have problems. It's just the worst. So best wishes for a speedy recovery. It's too bad he can't call 1-800-FELLA to fix his shoulder. He did note, Sheamus did, that this will be his first surgery of any kind. So now he can truly say that he is a WWE main eventer. I think it sucks that he got hurt, but I look at it as a positive for Sheamus. He's had no real direction for months now. You know, he's been stuck in limbo, really, since that Mark Henry feud after WrestleMania, where he was a dick to Henry every week on TV. Even though he was the babyface. I guess he feuded with Damian Sandow for a while. I know he was doing stuff with the Rhodes Scholars. It just felt like a placeholder more than anything else. His star has really fallen in recent months. And when they had the roster out on stage on Raw, if you remember, it was back in Brooklyn last month, and they did the whole deal where John Cena was going to pick his SummerSlam opponent, and he teased picking Sheamus among others, the fans booed. They actually booed when he suggested that he might pick Sheamus as his opponent. So, and they booed him other times also. He has good matches. I don't think that's the issue here. I think Sheamus is a good wrestler. But he's just very dull right now. There's no spark when it comes to the Sheamus character. So him disappearing for 4 to 6 months might just be what he needs to rejuvenate his character and come back fresh. If all goes well, he should be back in time for WrestleMania, and who knows, maybe even the Royal Rumble as a surprise entrant if he heals up quick enough. It's impossible to say what the landscape's going to look like 4 or 5 months from now in terms of who's feuding with who and any new guys they may bring up from NXT. But if you go back and watch that Money in the Bank match, I watched the portion where he got hurt. The injury came on a spot that involved Daniel Bryan. Bryan had a ladder in his hands, he was knocking people down with it, and he knocked Sheamus off the top rope, which caused him to crash through a ladder that I think Sheamus himself had set up on the outside. So right there, you've got a revenge program with Daniel Bryan ready to go when he comes back. You know, he not only helped cost this guy a Money in the Bank contract, but he cost him up to 6 months of his career. It would make more sense, I think, for Sheamus to be the heel, especially if Bryan is still a babyface at that point. Plus, not for nothing, I'm tired of smiling, joking babyface Sheamus. It just doesn't work for me. I'd prefer to see him turn, but I guess if Randy Orton turns first, I could see where they may not want both of them to be heels. I don't really think that matters because right now, if anything, WWE has a shortage of heels. You know, John Cena is the top babyface. Punk came back as a babyface. You have Bryan, RVD, Ziggler just turned babyface. Christian's a babyface. Sounds like Big Show may be coming back as a babyface, especially if they do anything with him and the Shield. Kane's a babyface. Jericho, even though he's gone right now. Even Cody Rhodes. Cody Rhodes just turned. So if things stay the way they are, believe me, even if Randy Orton turns, there's plenty of room for a heel Sheamus. He and Bryan have had some tremendous matches together. They have great chemistry in the ring, and now they'd have a real reason to feud with one another. I mean, even if Bryan is WWE champion at the time. If Bryan is champion when Sheamus comes back, all the better. You know that if the WWE champion is anyone but John Cena heading into WrestleMania, the title ain't going to headline that show. You know, Rock may come back and face Brock. Cena and Undertaker is still a match I would do next year if I were them. The off chance they get Austin to wrestle Punk, which looks unlikely. But at best, that would leave the WWE title match fourth on the card. And that sucks because the WWE title should not be fourth from the top on your biggest show of the year, but it would still be a high-profile match for Bryan and Sheamus, and what a story it would be to have those two, you know, 3 years removed from being bumped off the WrestleMania card to a dark match, and here they would be wrestling for the WWE Championship. So, again, 6 months is a long time. Who the hell knows what everything's going to look like in 6 months, but I think they've got a built-in story with Sheamus if they want to go for it, and personally, I think it's time to turn him back heel. I did end up watching week two of Total Divas on E!, wasn't sure if I was going to review it again this week. So I figured what I would do is this. I have this gimmick, as you all know, the Diva Stopwatch. Anybody who follows me on Twitter, at Solomonster, I time all of the Divas matches on Raw because they don't give these women any time to wrestle. And it's actually a little bit better than it was even a year ago. There was a point in time where literally these girls got 30 seconds every single week. At least now they get a couple of minutes. But I still do the Diva Stopwatch deal. So I figured, I don't want to spend too much time on this. I'm going to run a Diva stopwatch right now, and I'm going to time my Total Divas review. So this is my quick thoughts on episode 2 from last Sunday. The new girls hit up their first Raw taping. Eva Marie wants to be Fandango's dancer because he's the hot act, which tells you how far back this must be taped because he's about as hot now as an ice cube. And anyways, because she thinks it'll get her on the fast track to the main roster, so that's her intention here. Ariane ditches the WWE seamstress in favor of having some random dude make new outfits for her and Trinity to wear on TV, which blows up in their faces because Trinity's private parts are literally busting out of her clothes. She said this like this was a bad thing. I thought she looked great. In the end, they had to kiss and make up with the WWE lady. Ariane also dropped the phrase, thebomb.com. During this episode, making her even more hateable. Coincidentally, there is a website called thebomb.com. I looked this up, but all you see is a picture of what appears to be an airport bench. So Maybe she was just using it as a descriptive term for the show. We have a scene backstage where the Road Dog is going over spots backstage with the Bellas. Kayfabe is dead. We already knew that. Eva Marie goes to the talent relations folks to discuss her being Fandango's new dancer. They had no idea that she had a dance background, and neither did Eva Marie, because she has no dance background. She made it all up, just like this show. It's all made up. They give their blessing for her to audition, provided, of course, that Fandango is cool with it, as if that's how the whole thing works. You know, Fandango has to be okay with it, not Triple H, not the McMahons. Lucky for her, Fandango is more than okay with it. He walks off to take a shower, telling her that he'll be thinking of her while he's in the shower. Every single fan who has ever bitched about WWE being PG and wanting a more adult-oriented product should be watching this show. I'm not even saying it's any good, but this is what you wanted. It's all right here. You've got hot women with their boobs hanging out. You've got adult language. You've got sexual situations. It's like Vince Russo's wet dream. The only thing missing is Mae Young's hand and Sammy the Transvestite, who touched Mark Henry that one time. Daniel Bryan and Brie Bella join Nikki and John Cena on Cena's private jet. Nikki is upset about Eva Marie going on Twitter and saying that she would like to be Cena's tag team partner. Cena says he respects Eva Marie because she's bold and attracts attention, which is what you need to do to stand out. So basically, what he meant to say is, hell yes, I would love to tag team Eva Marie. With Nikki sitting right there, though, that would not have been advisable, especially not 35,000 feet in the air. Anyway, they're doing a life swap on the show where each couple flies to the other's home to see what life is like for them. So the first stop is Tampa, Florida, and John Cena's compound. I refuse to call it a house because calling it a house just doesn't do this place justice. It's like a fortress. I could live very comfortably in John Cena's closet or perhaps in his bathroom. The place is just unbelievable. He's even got his own waterfall. It's like having a Six Flags on your back porch. It almost makes you angry, but then you kind of stop and realize the dude has worked his ass off for 10 years. He probably never even gets to see the inside of his own home. You know what? He deserves it. Good for him. More older wrestlers would be able to live in a house like John Cena's if they actually had saved their money instead of pissing it all away. Elsewhere, we find out Eva Marie has a boyfriend when he surprised her at her hotel room. He then proposes to her and presents her with a ring, which she accepts. Mind you, they've been dating for a grand total of 2.5 months. And by her own admission, they have barely seen each other in that 2.5 months. Even Ric Flair thinks this will end badly. Case in point, once her fiancé leaves to go back home, the engagement ring that he just gave her comes off for her date with Fandango. She starts freaking out because she knows she can't dance, and Fandango does not know that. They go out to dinner together to get more acquainted. Fandango tells her that he and some of the boys are going out to a club later, and so he invites her to come out. Fandango so badly wants to get in this girl's pants. He's like every frat boy I see at a bar in New York. And you know what? If he played this character on TV instead of the one he does now, I think he'd get over huge as a heel. Back on the private jet, the Cenas and the Bryans are off now to Aberdeen, Washington, to Daniel Bryan's parents' old home, which he and Brie now supposedly live in together. They never said where Bryan's parents are, so I don't know if they moved elsewhere and he kept the house, or if they're dead, or what the deal is. It's a nice little house. Nothing like John Cena's Fortress of Solitude. Cena and Nikki can't believe that Brie actually likes living there. She's a California girl. She likes the sun and the beach. And here it's always rainy and gloomy. Well, that is the Pacific Northwest for you. So now we have drama. Cena is greatly appalled that Bryan does not own a television. And judging by shows like this, I can't say I blame him. They all decide to go have a wood chopping contest. And so while chopping wood, Nikki somehow manages to hit herself in her vagina. It's exactly what she said, her vagina. Then it's Cena's turn. The Bellas try to distract him by showing off their cleavage, and Cena responds with, "I already have wood, so it's not going to work." It's just a visual I don't need. Cena chops up a million pieces of wood, like an entire tree this man chopped. So victory appears far out of reach for the girls, but then Daniel Bryan, it's his turn. And he can't chop even one, not one piece of wood this man can chop. And he's the one from Aberdeen, it's his home. So the women win. So now it's time for Eva Marie's audition at Raw. It's a few hours before showtime. She comes out, dances about as well as a drunk girl. She can't ballroom dance to save her life. Jane, the talent relations woman, storms off in disgust. They ask Fandango if he wants to do another run-through. He says no and walks away. Eva Marie gets pulled into an office to meet with Stephanie McMahon, who's a very busy woman, especially on a Monday. She's getting ready for Raw. She can't be bothered with this kind of bullshit. So Stephanie says Eva has embarrassed herself and the company with her lying. Eva cries. She says it'll never happen again. Stephanie says she hopes not, or else she'll be gone, and she will not come back. And with that, Stephanie exits, and that's week two of Total Divas. Every scenario on this show came off as completely fake, but it had its moments. John Cena talking about having wood was not one of them, but it certainly had its moments. As I stopped the Divas stopwatch, 6 minutes, 53 seconds it took for me to get through that review, which is still far longer than any Divas match you'll see on Raw. They've had some pay-per-view ones, I guess, that have gone longer than that, but it took me longer to do that review than it does to get the women out there to have a match on TV. They got to work on that. Monday Night Raw this past week, live from Green Bay, Wisconsin. We're going to do the good, the bad, and the ugly random Raw observations. So a little bit of a format change here. Instead of ranking everything in a good column, bad column, we're just taking a little bit of everything here and just making some observations from the show this past Monday night. I like the stuff with Daniel Bryan at the beginning of the show. That was the segment with him and Vince McMahon, only because the direction they seem to be going with him and Cena at SummerSlam is, you know, Bryan is the wrestler and John Cena is the entertainer. So I like that. I like differentiating the two of them. Almost puts people on one side or the other. You either like wrestling or you don't. All the John Cena fans will love him. All the people who love wrestling, they love good action, they're going to side with Bryan. It's like a poor man's version of the whole USA versus Canada feud from 1997. They want people to take sides. He said that if he gets fired tomorrow, he'll be right back to the high school gyms and the armories in front of 30 people because he loves wrestling. And if John Cena got fired tomorrow, which is comical, but let's suspend our disbelief for a second. If he got fired, he probably wouldn't even wrestle another day in his life. Cena is loyal to WWE. He's not loyal to pro wrestling. He's got more money than God. What's he going to do? Go work for TNA? So Bryan said he'd play dress up for the McMahons for now. They did the whole corporate makeover thing. He was wearing a suit. His hair was slicked back with a little ponytail. But he said at SummerSlam, he's going to make John Cena tap out. I still don't see it happening. It just goes against everything Cena, the character, is about with the whole never give up stuff. I'd say there's a better chance of them teasing a tap out on a yes lock spot than later he just kind of wins the championship with a small package out of nowhere. I do feel weird talking about another dude and using the term small package, I have to say. I imagine that would be an awkward conversation to have with a non-wrestling fan. They did do the tease with Vince McMahon telling Bryan to shave off the beard. As I said last week, they probably would do that. He brought out Wade Barrett, of all people, to be the barber. Barrett the barber. That could be his new gimmick. Bryan gave him a headbutt. He ended up shaving off part of Barrett's beard instead. And then Daniel Bryan revealed his new t-shirt, which is basically John Cena's crappy new shirt with the arrow that says the champ is here. Only Bryan's shirt points up, the arrow does, and it says the beard is here. Better than the rape shirt he was wearing, I guess. It's an improvement. Still a crappy shirt. I think it'd be funnier and probably a lot more revolting if they made one for the ladies with the arrow pointing down. But I digress. I like the wrestler versus entertainer theme, like I said. Other than that, this just went way too long. It was like 20 minutes long. And they really have to be careful here because the more they go out of their way, I think, to blatantly try to get the people behind Daniel Bryan with these campy segments and the crappy t-shirts and all that stuff. Because really, this whole segment, this 20-minute segment, was just intended to sell a t-shirt. I mean, that was it. So you're treading on dangerous ground here. You got to be careful. Because what you don't want to have another John Cena on your hands where people start resenting him and it starts to feel forced. You know, the whole thing with Daniel Bryan, it's an organic thing right now. Don't force it. Just book him well and he'll take care of the rest. Rob Van Dam pinned Alberto Del Rio in a non-title match. Ricardo Rodriguez was back from his suspension. After the match, Del Rio absolutely murdered Ricardo. Just absolutely killed him for inadvertently costing him the match. Ricardo had tried to use the bucket to help Del Rio, but it backfired. So it looks like Del Rio and Rodriguez are done as a unit. I do love this notion, which was reported in this week's Wrestling Observer, that Vince McMahon felt Ricardo was essentially holding Del Rio back from getting over as a heel. So that's why they broke him up. And that's why, you know, Alberto was not over with the audience, as though it's Ricardo's fault. Sure. Sure. That's a logical explanation. I'm sure it has absolutely nothing at all to do with the fact that Del Rio gets beaten on TV every single week. Just look at this week alone. Forget the last few months. Let's look at this week. He got pinned by Van Damme on this show. And on SmackDown, he got pinned by Christian, his opponent at SummerSlam, who he's now wrestled twice on television before the pay-per-view, and he lost both times. It just makes you want to pull your hair out. It just can't be this hard. I'm not saying it's an easy job to book and all that stuff. It cannot be this hard. I don't know why they do the things they do sometimes. Cody Rhodes somehow managed to fish Damian Sandow's Money in the Bank briefcase out of the Gulf of Mexico. It looked to contain the contents of Henry Godwin's old slop bucket inside. Damian tried to get it back. Cody beat him up. Crowd didn't give a shit about any of this, which is depressing. I actually like this feud. It's a nice little mid-card feud. They tease Sandow cashing in until Rio on SmackDown. He's got a new briefcase now, but Cody foiled his plans there. To be honest, I know Green Bay is a big football town, lots of sports fans there, but this crowd sucked. They were dead for almost everything on this show. This was one of them. I also want to know why Michael Cole keeps saying that Sandow stole the contract at Money in the Bank from Cody. It was every man for himself. He won the match fair and square. You know, as Bobby Heenan would say, I'd push my grandmother off that ladder if it meant me getting a world title contract, so I fail to see what Damian Sandow did that was so wrong other than being a bad friend. Mark Henry and Ryback, they hyped this up as a WrestleMania 29 rematch after maybe 60 seconds of action, and I think I'm being generous there. Ryback just walked out, and Henry got the win. I did chuckle at Ryback as he backed up the ramp when he was leaving. He said, he's just like talking out loud, and he says, "The big guy's going home." I did find that kind of amusing, but yeah, between us already getting a When Raw Rolls On from Michael Cole before one of the commercial breaks, and then them beating the world champion yet again, I was waiting, just waiting for the Fandango walkout to complete the trifecta, and we got the hat trick, but we got it with Ryback instead of Fandango. That's how predictable this show has become. Within the first hour of this show, we got the hat trick. They couldn't even spread it out over the course of the show. We got it all pretty much in hour one. John Cena did a promo. Normally I would go on to talk about all the things about it I did not like, but I actually did like John Cena's promo on this show, as I did Daniel Bryan's earlier. Cena took a more serious tone. I am amused when John Cena goes all thug on us, back to his rapper days, as he did here, from the mean streets of West Newbury, Massachusetts. It came off almost more like a heel promo to me. The way he ran down wrestling, he said wrestling anywhere else but WWE doesn't matter. WWE is the only game in town. I got the impression, just listening to this, that John Cena is no fan of Ring of Honor. Actually, if WWE had Cena take this act on the road just so they can film footage of him at some of these small indie shows and air it on TV, I think that'd be awesome. You know, just him running down the shows, the wrestlers, the promoters, maybe buying a ticket and sitting in amongst the fans. It'd be a total zoo, and this man would be hated. I guess it doesn't make sense if he's still a babyface, but if they ever turn John Cena heel, I think that's a great gimmick for him. John Cena, the indie killer. So Randy Orton came out to remind us that Cena has the championship, and Orton is going to cash in on him when he least expects it. Shield came out to put an end to this promo, which is another great gimmick I'd love to see them start using. The Shield, hate injustice. Well, I can't tell you how many of these promo segments are an injustice, so they could just cue up the Shield's music and send them out there to end really bad promos that go on for way too long. I guess that would turn them babyface, though, so that's probably a bad idea. Daniel Bryan ran in to even the odds, and Brad Maddox made a six-man main event of John Cena, Randy Orton, and Daniel Bryan against the Shield. I was very excited about this when he announced it, particularly if they were going to give these guys 20 minutes. I figured that most Shield matches go a long time, so I was very happy to hear this, but they didn't give them anywhere close to 20 minutes. I'll get to that later. John Cena hurt his elbow also on the African tour recently. It looked... the only way I could describe it is it kind of looked like a baseball was stuck inside his elbow. Or like his elbow had its own elbow that it was growing. It's just absolutely disgusting. He could start using Dusty Rhodes' bionic elbow as his finisher. It'd be a more believable finish than his STF with that thing looking the way it does. Wyatt Family and Kane. Kane appeared on the big screen. He said at SummerSlam, no one will be able to save Bray from inside a ring of fire. I immediately thought Inferno match, and it turns out they're calling it a ring of fire match at SummerSlam, which actually sounds cooler, I think. And really, it isn't an Inferno match. So for all the people complaining, oh, they changed the name, why not just call it an Inferno match? As far as I know, the rules are different in that in an Inferno match, the object is to set your opponent on fire, as Kane and Undertaker did. I think Kane and MVP maybe were the last ones to have an Inferno match. I think MVP actually got legitimately burned in that match. But that's the object of an Inferno match. You can't do that here now because it's PG. You're not going to set somebody on fire. So here, the ring will be surrounded by fire to keep out Luke Harper and Eric Rowan, but you beat your opponent by pinfall or submission. So, Bray Wyatt, his first match is on pay-per-view, and it's inside a ring of fire. Could be his last match, too, if he's not careful. It goes against logic, I guess, to have the first match of the feud be a gimmick. But if Kane is leaving soon to go film See No Evil 2, which starts production in the fall, they just announced that he is doing a sequel to that film, I guess it's fine if they use this as a way to write him out of storylines. Maybe Kane will end up getting set on fire anyway. Caitlyn beat Layla in 3 minutes 4 seconds, according to my trusty Divas stopwatch. So think about that. My total Divas review was twice the amount of time that Caitlyn versus Layla lasted on Monday night. This came after Layla turned on Caitlyn on SmackDown the week before. AJ skipped down to the ring. She distracted Caitlyn, which led to the finish. The good news is they found something to get Layla more TV time. The bad news is they found something to get Layla more TV time. And I say that because that means her horrid entrance music is back. I'm just begging somebody to find her a boy already and just spare us this pain. God, I can't stand that theme song. One of our listeners, Matthew, on Twitter, was wondering if they might actually go the lesbian route and make Layla AJ's next love interest, given how close they've become and the fact that AJ has pretty much blown through most of the men on the roster. You thought I was going to say something else, didn't you? But they would never do that. I don't think that would be a bad idea, even. It would be kind of intriguing, I think, to see the two of them be more than just friends, but ain't going to happen. We had an awesome CM Punk, Paul Heyman, Brock Lesnar segment on this show. Awesome stuff. It was Punk versus Curtis Axel. They were having a good match. It even got a This Is Awesome chant, which... talk about bastardizing a chant. I mean, it was good, but let's not get carried away here. Punk got a lot of offense in on Lesnar before Brock made his comeback. This was the big brawl that happened at the end of the match. Lesnar left Punk laying with a magnificent F5. I mean, I think Punk is still flying through the air as we speak. Brock pummeled Punk with a steel chair. Any object in Brock Lesnar's hands is a lethal weapon. I don't care what it is. It could be a freaking spatula. I don't care. If it's in Brock Lesnar's hands, he'll find a way to hurt you with it. Somewhere in the middle of all this, Punk's chin got lacerated. He needed 4 stitches after the show to close the cut. From start to finish, this was all about Punk getting his hands on Paul Heyman. Even during the match with Axel, he was constantly trying to get his hands on Heyman. He got a hold of Paul, but that was the point that Brock came out. They brawled. Punk got the upper hand. He had Heyman in his sights. Brock cut him off again. Punk wants so badly to get to Paul Heyman, and people will pay money to see it happen. Everything about this segment I thought was great. And I see where some people feel Punk maybe got too much offense in on Brock, but you've got to give people a reason to believe that CM Punk has a fighting chance against Brock Lesnar at SummerSlam. You know, to believe that he can be competitive with a guy that's twice his size. Otherwise, people won't buy it. It's not believable enough for them. So I have no problem with that, especially since in every confrontation so far that they've had, Brock has been the one left standing tall, and Punk has been the one left laying in the end.
A lot of people see this match between me and CM Punk at SummerSlam as a personal issue between Punk and Paul Heyman, with me just being there as Paul's muscle. But let me make it clear, it is personal between me and Punk. I've never liked Punk. He walks around here calling himself the best in the world. Look at him, and look at me. I look at him and see a joke. The only reason I let him exist all this time is out of respect for Paul. The corporate idiots are calling this match at SummerSlam the best versus the beast. You listen to me. The beast is the best, and you're looking at him. Punk thinks just because he tapes his hands and has a bunch of tattoos and takes MMA classes for beginners at his local gym that he's a tough guy. Well, he's not. People have asked me if there's any professional jealousy between me and Punk. What do I have to be jealous of? Was Punk an NCAA Division I heavyweight champ?
No.
Was Punk a UFC heavyweight champion?
No.
There is no jealousy in Brock Lesnar. And as far as him being WWE champion, I was the undisputed WWE champion back when CM Punk was wrestling for 100 people in high school gyms. But CM Punk has never faced anybody in his entire life like me.
Me.
Because there is nobody like me.
Me.
Size does matter. At SummerSlam, CM Punk is going to learn what it means to truly be victimized by Brock Lesnar.
Backstage, Renee Young was there with Heyman, Lesnar, and Curtis Axel. Brock grabbed the microphone and said that he was the best and the beast. And then in one of the best lines on Raw in ages, he said, "Paul, say something stupid." And everyone in the audience laughed their ass off when he said it. That was quite the great moment. And then Paul actually did say something stupid. He challenged CM Punk to a match on Raw this Monday. So that will be your main event. If they have Punk do anything more than just grab Heyman, I think they're out of their minds. It's obviously a swerve of some kind, but I don't want them giving anything away, not even a little bit, before the swerve happens. So that should be saved for SummerSlam or whatever the next pay-per-view is after that if they want to drag this thing out even more. Another observation here, Kofi Kingston is back. He's looking noticeably smaller than he was when he left. He did have elbow surgery, so that's, I guess, understandable. He may not have, a lot of definition. He may not have been able to work out much in terms of weightlifting and all that. But he was also back to wearing pants. I think early in his career, he wore long pants. So he's got new ring gear and is no longer wearing tights. So I don't know. I mean, was he not able to work out his legs? I don't really understand that. He beat Fandango with his Trouble in Paradise kick. Then Fandango got his win back on SmackDown. So I guess they're all even now. Let's see, what else here? Oh, Big E Langston and Dolph Ziggler had yet another match, and it was not at SummerSlam, which is disappointing. Crowd was completely dead for this match. Caitlyn came out to go after AJ. She even chased her into the ring, and the referee never bothered calling for a disqualification. This after CM Punk put his hands on Paul Heyman during Punk's match with Axel, and the referee immediately called for the DQ. All Punk did was grab Heyman. Heyman is actually still outside the ring. And Punk reached out and grabbed him, and the ref called for the DQ. And I don't want to hear this crap about how, well, you know, because Heyman and Punk touched, and Caitlyn and AJ didn't touch Ziggler or Big E. If you don't belong in the match and you enter the ring, you're in that zone, then the referee should call for the disqualification. Period. End of story. I just hate this selective officiating that they have. Remember back at Extreme Rules, the I Quit match between Del Rio and Jack Swagger? Zeb Coulter threw that towel in for Del Rio. The referee thought it was Ricardo throwing the towel in, so Swagger won the match. And then they brought out a flat screen panel for Mike Chioda to watch the replay, and he saw what actually happened, and then the match continued. Instant replay in WWE. Yeah. How many questionable calls have there been since then? A lot, right? Now, how many times have they used instant replay? None. Not a single time. It's just so stupid to me. Langston won the match with the big end after the distraction. Commentary had JBL talking about how Caitlyn just ruins everything, he said. I don't know why I thought that was quite funny. Probably because he's right. So now at SummerSlam, we get a mixed tag match. Ziggler and Caitlyn against Big E and AJ. So I guess it gets the women a role on the show, but in my opinion, it makes the match worse. So depending on your perspective, I don't know if that's a good thing or not. I think matches that aren't as good as they could be are generally, that's generally a bad thing, but maybe that's just me. Cena, Orton, and Bryan beat The Shield by DQ in a very disappointing main event. They barely gave these guys any time at all to get going, and then they gave us a shitty finish on top of that. Orton RKO'd Daniel Bryan and John Cena after the match. Then he acted like he was going to cash in his briefcase on Cena, but The Shield walked back to the ring, and he changed his mind pretty quick. Two attempted Money in the Bank cash-ins in the same week. Shield was left standing at the end of the show, which is great, except they have no match for SummerSlam. So whatever they had planned with Mark Henry and the Big Show against The Shield, unless they add it on the go-home show this Monday, because Big Show is still rehabbing from some sort of hip surgery he just had, unless they add it as a last-minute deal, Shield ain't going to be on this show. One of the biggest shows of the year, they're not even on the card. These men hold two of the six championships in WWE, the tag team title and the U.S. title. That's three belts total that they have, and they may not even be on the show. Just completely ridiculous. So the Bryan Cena promo stuff was pretty good. The stuff with Punk, Heyman, and Lesnar was fantastic as usual. Everything else on this show was pretty much just a waste of time. SummerSlam card so far looks like this. John Cena, Daniel Bryan for the WWE Championship. Punk versus Brock. Best versus the Beast. World Championship on the line. Alberto Del Rio against Christian, I guess, in what will be their third match, unless they put them on Raw again this week. You know, why not just have them wrestle on Raw and SmackDown this week while you're at it? Cody Rhodes and Damian Sandow. I don't know if it'll be for the Money in the Bank contract. They have not said that it would be, but it could be added. Kane and Bray Wyatt in a Ring of Fire match, and Dolph Ziggler and Caitlyn against Big E Langston and AJ Lee. There are rumors I read of a Rob Van Dam Antonio Cesaro match for the pre-show. At least that's what I've heard. At least they're not putting champions on the pre-show anymore. That's a plus. But both of those guys are not involved in any program right now. You know, Cesaro is just kind of there, and RVD's not doing much of anything. So why not? Why not put the two of them together? I think they could have a kick-ass match. Maybe it gets a few more people to order the pay-per-view. We'll do predictions for SummerSlam on the show next week. NXT from Full Sail University. Another fine 45 minutes this week of wrestling. Before the opening match, ring announcer Byron Saxton informed us that Tyler Breeze has entered the building. Oh, yes. That's what I said. That is great news. We've only seen one match from Tyler Breeze so far, and I'm already a big fan of his. Tom Phillips and Alex Riley handled the announcing duties this week. That's also great news because that means with the promotion of Brad Maddox to Raw GM, that means we no longer have to suffer through Brad Maddox on commentary. I think Brad Maddox is a great on-air television character. I think he's actually really good in his current role. As an announcer, he sucks. He was just terrible on this show. He would constantly distract from the action. I thought Alex Riley was actually quite good on this show. Adrian Neville and Dean Ambrose had a match for the United States Championship. Match was fine. Very basic. Nothing really special. I guess I expected more out of this. Didn't really get it. Neville nailed his corkscrew finish off the top rope. They did a hell of a false finish here that made you think that there was going to be a title change. But then at the last possible second, Seth Rollins and Roman Reigns ran in for the DQ. I thought that was well done. Corey Graves and Xavier Woods ran down to make the save. That sets up our main event for next week, The Shield, against Woods, Graves, and Neville. They should break into the show each week to give Cassius Ohno physique updates. You know, like those old Randy Orton RNN updates when he was out hurt early in his career. They could show Ohno lifting weights at the new performance center with Triple H standing behind him, just berating him, telling him he'll never make it to the main roster unless he does another rep. You know, those pecs aren't going to pop themselves. I think that'd be very entertaining. And then you just see, like, Mason Ryan walk by and just look at Ohno and just shake his head and keep walking. I got all these ideas floating in my head here. Emma versus Summer Rae in a dance battle to determine the number one contender to the NXT Women's Championship. Yes, they're having a fucking dance contest to determine who will wrestle Paige for the title. And to think, I wrote a whole column on the Divas last week on the Layfield Report about how we may be on the verge of a rebirth for the division, and then they pull this crap. I don't have a problem with them doing a dance battle. I actually thought this was entertaining, but not to determine your number one contender. I mean, come on. Emma won the contest. It was by fan vote, so of course they booed Summer Rae at the end. They cheered Emma, so she won. And even though Emma won the dance battle fair and square, Summer Rae nailed her with her finish. I don't know the name of it. It's Big Show's old final cut move where he just kind of puts his leg up in the air and leg drops you down. One very weak-looking leg drop by Summer Rae lays out Emma, and they announce that Summer Rae will now get the title shot against Paige, I guess because Emma is injured. I got an idea. Let's punish her. Let's punish Summer Rae for what she just did by giving her a title shot. Brilliant. Brilliant move. Tyler Breeze made his entrance, which is still great. I'm not sick of it yet. I still love this. He also beat some dude named Danny Burch, but that's not really important. This week, they had Breeze's iPhone synced up with the mini Titantron that they have. So while he was filming himself through his phone, you could actually see it up on the big screen. I can't say that I've actually seen that before, so I thought that was kind of cool. Renee Young interviewed Bo Dallas backstage before his big title defense against the South African Leo Kruger. Not to be confused with the South African Josie the Wrestling Machine who attacked Randy Orton. He won't be getting a title shot anytime soon. Dallas is now starting to heal it up a bit, which is actually very cool to see. He referred to Antonio Cesaro as a good kid with a bright future ahead of him. And he said the only reason that he got pinned by Kruger last week in that tag team match was because his partner Sami Zayn is still very inexperienced. Oh, the irony of that statement. Then he started singing Don't Stop Believing as he walked off. I think he's boring in the ring, and in fact the fans have now started chanting Bo Ring at him. But I may be coming around on this guy's character. He keeps doing this. Also, the other thing I wanted to mention here, I keep hearing about this Antonio Cesaro, Sami Zayn, 2 out of 3 falls match. Even Jim Ross, I think, praised it. Did I miss it? Did it already air? Or has it not aired yet? Because I'm wondering when the hell we're going to get to see this match. Apparently, it's not going to be next week. So I'm just wondering how many more weeks I have to wait, or did I miss it? Maybe somebody can give me an update on that. Back in the ring, Byron Saxton informed us that Tyler Breeze has left the building. I thought about turning the show off at this point, but I did soldier on for the main event. Bo Dallas and Leo Kruger for the NXT Championship. Good match. You'd think Kruger was the biggest babyface on NXT the way the fans reacted to him here. That's how badly they dislike Bo Dallas. Anywhere in there with Dallas is going to get cheered. Dallas won the match with his step-over wristlock-looking submission hold. Actually, it might have been the first time he ever used this move. If that's his new finisher, I'm all in favor of it. Anything is better than that god-awful belly-to-belly suplex he's been using. It could have just been a one-time thing, being that Kruger put him in his own submission hold, and then Bo escaped and countered with a submission of his own. I think he should keep it and just use it every week. So Bo Dallas retains the title, much to the crowd's chagrin. One last NXT note here. Garrett Dillon, whose real name is Jody Christofferson. He is the son of singer and actor Chris Christofferson. He was released this past week. He had been one half of Sylvester Lefort's Country Boy tag team with Scott Dawson. I was never really into their act, as many of you who listen to these reviews could tell. I didn't think much of them. They bored me, so I can't really say that this is any great loss to NXT. And as they bring in more talent with this new performance center, they could have up to 100 guys in there at once if they want to. I think right now they have about 75 guys down in developmental in that center. You know, guys like this are going to become more and more expendable. Kind of like Bruce Willis found out this week when Stallone replaced him in the next Expendables movie with Harrison Ford. A guy who has not made a good movie since Air Force One in 1997. And don't give me that Indiana Jones garbage either, because that was complete crap. Stallone supposedly offered Bruce Willis $3 million for 4 days of filming. And Bruce Willis said, no, I want $4 million. So basically, $1 million a day to film a few scenes in a movie that already has a gazillion other action stars on board. I love Bruce Willis to death. He'll always be John McClane to me. Those Die Hard movies, the original Die Hard, one of the best movies ever made. But the dude is whacked out of his mind. That's all I got to say about that. Let's move on to TNA here. Impact Wrestling this week was a taped show for from Wichita Falls, Texas. We'll get to the show in a second. Let's get some TNA news out of the way first. On her Twitter, earlier in the week, Dixie Carter posted the following. She said, "Today, Kurt Angle entered a rehab facility. As a cherished member of the TNA family, we support his decision and wish him strength through this difficult, important recovery process." If they cherish him so much and they want to keep him on the roster, they should pay for a driver to take him from town to town. For DUI or DWI arrest, he shouldn't be allowed to operate a vehicle anymore. According to Fighting Spirit magazine, Magnus has re-signed with TNA. He told the magazine, "I'm very happy to confirm that I have signed a new two-year deal on improved terms. It came down to the wire between TNA, myself, and my agent, but ultimately, we came to a mutually beneficial agreement." Came down to the wire, you don't say. That seems to be a pattern with TNA. But, hey, at least they signed him. Magnus is a guy that I look at. He's got a presence about him. I think he could be a big star. So good for TNA. The magazine also claims that Samoa Joe and Bobby Roode have also signed new deals with TNA. So that's great news for them. Some positive TNA news for a change. And then there's Hulk Hogan. This is a video right here for TV Tracks. I know there's a lot of Hogan lovers on there. Hulk Hogan told TMZ that a movie about his life is already in the works, and that the person that he would like to see play him is his son, Nasty Nick Hogan, perhaps the only man more dangerous behind the wheel than Kurt Angle. He claims that the movie is being worked on right now, even though nobody has heard word one about this before TMZ bumped into him at the airport. Remember, this is the same man who claims the role of Randy the Ram in the movie The Wrestler was originally intended for him. He says he only turned it down because he thought the movie was so good, and the casting him, as popular as he is, would somehow detract from the movie. He said they came to him with the script like three times, and he turned them down each time. The only problem with that is that the director called him out on his bullshit on Twitter and revealed that, in fact, the role was never intended for Hogan. Just like he claims, he's always told this story. And who really knows if it's true? See, the problem with Hogan is that if his lips are moving, he's lying. You never know what to believe. But he's always told the story about the George Foreman grill and how that could have been his endorsement deal, but when the agent called him, he missed the phone call because he was picking his kids up or something like that, and so it went to George Foreman instead, and it's made like hundreds of millions of dollars. Instead, they came out with a Hulk Hogan blender, and it died a death. That's the version he told on Hogan Knows Best. But again, he can't keep track of his own BS because he's also told the story that, you see, what actually happened is that he was talking to his manager, and his manager tells him, "Hey, you have to put your name on kitchen appliances. That's big business right there. You got to get your name, your brand on all these different kitchen appliances. There's this meatball maker," and Hogan likes it, and he says, "Great, let's do the Hulkamania meatball maker." And the manager says, "Well, what about this other thing I have?" And Hogan just tells him, "Just give that to your other client." And that client just so happened to be George Foreman. Two very different stories, equally amusing, but two very different stories. Meanwhile, Hogan did come out with his own grill years later. Remember the Hulk Hogan Ultimate Grill? You don't remember it? You know why you don't remember it? Because it was condemned as a fire hazard. That's why. The grill would burst into flames if you used cooking oil on it. It could burn your entire friggin' house down. It really is just entertaining to hear Hogan spin these tales. Far more entertaining than he is on TV. I love the Hulkster. Don't get me wrong. I can't bash him today. Today's his birthday. Hulk Hogan turns 60 years old today. So say what you want to about the guy, but nobody has had the kind of staying power in wrestling that he's had. I may not be a wrestling fan today were it not for that Hulkamania boom of the 1980s. You know, back then, everything revolved around him, much like it probably does today for a lot of younger fans with John Cena. And who knows, maybe 30 years from now, we'll still see Cena on TV making matches and doing bad acting with his daughter. Or worse, maybe we'll still have Hogan on TV in 30 years. He is immortal. I thought Impact this week was a pretty weak show overall, not going to lie. I fell asleep in the middle of it. It was all about building up next week's Hardcore Justice special, which has Chris Sabin defending the TNA title against Bully Ray in a steel cage match, where if Bully loses, he can never again challenge for the championship. why do they feel the need to telegraph these finishes like that? Did they really have to add that stipulation to this match? Was that really necessary? It's not enough just to promote a cage match for the title with two dudes who hate each other. Aces and Sevens will meet the Main Event Mafia in what I presume will now be a 4-on-4 match with Kurt Angle being in rehab. Whoever takes the losing fall must leave TNA forever, or 3 months, whichever comes first. We have a 4-way ladder match with Jeff Hardy, AJ Styles, Austin Aries, and Frankie Kazarian for 20 points in the Bound for Glory series. And there will be a Knockouts Tornado Tag Team match pitting Mickie James and Gail Kim against Velvet Sky and ODB. I don't even know what other women they have on the roster right now. Reportedly, Taryn Terrell is pregnant, which, if that's true, she's going to be out for a while. They fired Tara. They released Madison Rayne, who's also pregnant. Boy, a lot of Knockouts getting knocked up these days, huh? Who else am I missing? We got Miss Tessmacher. So that's five. Five active wrestlers. That's it. I think that's all they have left. Brooke Hogan doesn't wrestle, thank Christ, so she doesn't count. Christy Hemme, SoCal Val, who else they have? They don't wrestle. And to think, the Knockouts used to be one of the strongest parts of that product. I mean, if you really look at the WWE Divas, it's not like they've got 10 or 15 active Divas on their roster either, but you can't compare the two just because WWE just doesn't, they don't do anything with their Divas. You know what I mean? It's like, it's almost expected that they're just not going to do anything with their women. But I never felt that way about TNA. I always felt like they got a strong core of women. They put more of a focus on the women. Hell, they've had additions of Impact before, like with Mickey. I think it was it Mickey and Tara who actually headlined? Maybe it was Mickey and Gail Kim, but they actually headlined Impact. This wasn't that long ago. So it's kind of a shame to see a lot of the female talent they had is no longer around. They either left, they got fired, whatever the case may be. It's not like they have a developmental territory like WWE has with all these different women waiting to be called up. It's kind of a shame. Backstage, Taz was pissed off about being banned from the building last week. He told Mike Tenay to hit the bricks. He was going to be doing commentary with Jeremy Borash tonight. I think this may have been the first Impact, maybe the first TNA show ever, where Mike Tenay did not announce. Maybe I'm wrong. God knows I stayed away during much of the Russo era, but regardless, it was a refreshing change. I've never really been a big advocate of Tenay, so I didn't mind this at all. What I did mind was Mr. Anderson being on commentary for the first couple of segments. I can't stand his promos, so you can imagine my delight seeing him ringside with a headset on. He said absolutely nothing funny. He said nothing important. He was just generally obnoxious. Bully Ray came out, talked about tonight's main event being he and D-Von against Chris Sabin and a mystery partner. What the fuck is TNA's obsession with mystery person angles? It's a mystery how TNA is still in business. That's the real mystery. Sabin came out for the contract signing for their match next week. He recited some awful dialogue. I mean, he looked and sounded like a total dweeb here in this segment. He said something about feces. I don't remember the exact line. It's possible he was referring to the Tito Ortiz reveal from last week. Brooke Hogan came out. Oh, goody. Bully told the production guys to turn off her music. He said nobody wanted to listen to her stupid music. Ain't that the truth? She said her father was out of town at a meeting with the board. She said Hulk had been reviewing Bully's contract and sent her an email saying that if Bully loses the match with Sabin next week, he will never get another title shot ever again. Brooke came down to the ring, and boy, you see Brooke Hogan standing next to Chris Sabin. What a horrible visual that is for Sabin. She just towered over this guy like a giant. Bully signed the contract, then Sabin signed it, so it is official for Hardcore Justice. Jeff Hardy beats Samoa Joe for 7 points in the Bound for Glory series. Joe gets Hardy in the Coquina clutch. Anderson, this is exactly what happened here, okay? I'm not exaggerating or paraphrasing. What happened here is Joe got Hardy in the choke, and Anderson, who's still ringside at the announce desk, just stands up. He didn't, throw his headset down and storm the ring, but then stop short of coming into the ring. He just stood up at the announce desk. And this was enough to distract Samoa Joe, who got schoolboyed and pinned. Boy, does he look like a fool. Best part of the show was Anderson leaving the announce booth. It was also the worst part of the show because that meant he had to wrestle. He beat Magnus by DQ after Bobby Roode interfered and attacked Anderson with a steel chair. Magnus is so far ahead of everybody else on points in the Bound for Glory series that this was Bobby Roode's clever way of playing catch-up. The DQ loss for Magnus means he actually loses 10 points. So it's clever of the Bobby Roode character for trying to do this, but just completely idiotic that TNA would simply allow Roode to do this and get away with it. And he promises to do it again. So you would hope at some point TNA will put their foot down, or Hogan or somebody, and say, listen, this is not going to happen. But so far, it's an ingenious way, I suppose, to get points away from Magnus. Tito Ortiz came out to deliver his first promo since returning to TNA last week. He started to explain why he was here when suddenly Kurt Angle interrupted him. Angle gave basically the exact same speech he gave to Rampage Jackson when he debuted, and they had their little stare down. Is he going to do this for every MMA guy who comes in? Just kind of pull the little pull string in Kurt Angle's back, and he recites the same speech? Bully Ray came out. He ran both of them down. He was kind of funny here. He claimed he could come down to that ring and double leg Tito Ortiz and make him tap. I personally would love to see him try. And that was it. Ortiz left when it was over. He never bothered to go back and explain why he was there. A waste of time, this entire segment was. Later on, backstage, Ortiz promised that he would be at Hardcore Justice. I stick to my idea that he somehow cost Rampage the match next week, either accidentally or on purpose, and the Mafia will lose. James Storm, who spent last week's show live-tweeting, teamed with Gunner and ODB to beat Robbie E., Jesse Godders, and Mickey James. Storm and Gunner pin Robbie. After the match, Gail Kim ran out to attack ODB. You know, it hit me watching this match here. Between James Storm drinking beer on his way to the ring and ODB drinking out of her flask during the match, it's no wonder Kurt Angle's in rehab. I don't know that TNA is the best working environment for a guy like Kurt Angle right now, not with all those bad influences around him. Speaking of bad influence, I think that may have been the best segue I've ever used on this show. Kazarian and Daniels were scheduled to have a match in the Bound for Glory series. All night long, they were teasing dissension in the ranks. They had an interview backstage with Daniels. They had one with Kazarian. It looked like Kazarian maybe was going to turn babyface, and this may spell the end of their tag team. Well, I'm happy to report that it was, in fact, all a ruse. They basically did the Shawn Michaels Triple H European title match deal from 15 years ago, where they pretend to fight each other, or the finger poke of doom, if you want to use that. There was some mat wrestling early on, and then both guys just bailed out of the ring, and they forced referee Earl Hebner to count them both out, giving each man 2 points in the Bound for Glory series. Afterwards, Bobby Roode came back out with the chair. Instead of attacking Kaz and Daniels, he invited them into the ring with him, and he cut a promo to announce that they were now a trio. Bobby Roode, Austin Aries was part of this. Bobby Roode, Chris Daniels, and Frankie Kazarian together working as a unit. Yet another stable in TNA. Roode said that he, Daniels, and Kazarian have been overlooked with the arrival of all these MMA guys. Well, that's the understatement of the year, I think. He said they were forming an alliance to guarantee that one of them would win the Bound for Glory series this year. Just remember, kids, there is no honor among thieves. This alliance will not last long. But for now, I think it's great. I like seeing these guys together. It's just too bad they ended the Bobby Roode Austin Aries team, because I thought they were one of the best things about TNA. Main event was Chris Sabin and a mystery partner who turned out to be Kurt Angle, beating Team 3D in a long match. They worked over Sabin's leg, so I guess that's the thing now with him, because he's got two bum wheels. So I guess they figure working on either leg gets instant heat. I was in and out of consciousness during this match. I was just very tired. It's not their fault. I was also just very bored, quite frankly, by this show. I know they did lay out Kurt Angle with the 3D, which is still one of the coolest-looking tag team finishers after all these years. Devon went and brought a table into the ring. He propped it up in the corner. Bully Ray ended up crashing through the table inadvertently, and Sabin won the match by pinning Bully Ray after a crossbody off the top rope. So all of these victories for Sabin and him standing tall, plus that ridiculous stipulation they added this week, all but guarantees that Bully is going to get the belt back on Impact this Thursday. I just can't see Sabin being champion heading into Bound for Glory. You know, they need a strong heel in that match, and Bully Ray, whatever you may think of Bully Ray, he's the closest thing they've got to a legitimate heel. A strong heel on that roster. So this was a very forgettable show. Hopefully Hardcore Justice can ratchet up some of the excitement, because the TNA product overall right now just feels very stagnant. Hey guys, Solomonster here. As many of you know, I am a proud contributor to the Layfield Report, a website brought to you by Michael Cole and the longest reigning WWE champion in SmackDown history, John Bradshaw Layfield. There you'll find all the latest news and opinion from the world of professional wrestling, business, politics, sports, and more. Even better, you'll find me. You can show your support for my work there by scrolling down and finding the latest blog hit rankings on the right-hand side. Then, click on the name Jason Solomon, that's me, for a list of all my latest work. The more people who read these columns, the better, so be sure to share with your friends on Twitter and Facebook and help show your support for the Solomonster and the Sound Off. This week, I talk about Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman, why they are the greatest duo in WWE history, what makes their combination work so well, and the ongoing storyline with Lesnar, Heyman, and CM Punk. Read all about it exclusively on the Layfield Report. Go to layfieldreport.com right now. Time to break into the mailbag. If you have questions, you can always email them to me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. I've gotten a ton of questions this week, more than usual. I have not been able to get to everybody's yet. I will, so just bear with me on that. Also, if you want to send in audio questions, we don't have one this week, but if you want to send in your own, MP3 format only, keep it to around 30 seconds, give or take. And please include the question in written form in the body of the email you send with the attachment as well. This first question, I did get audio, but it really wasn't quality-wise the greatest, so I'll just read it here. This is from Gareth from Ireland. On Sound Off episode 285, you said that three-hour Raws are still too long, but would Daniel Bryan have gained popularity without these three-hour shows to showcase his wrestling ability in long matches, particularly those 20-minute matches against The Shield? Yes. He would have, because he's that good. He was already getting over. I think the ability for him to go out there for 15, 20, 22 minutes, whatever it may be, and have those kinds of matches opened up a lot more eyes. But if you went out there and had great 12-minute matches, I think he still would have gotten over. So I don't think you could just say, well, because Raw is 3 hours, that's one of the reasons why Daniel Bryan is so over, to a degree. But it's not enough to make me say, well, you know what, it's worth it. Let's keep the three-hour Raw shows. I mean, they're going to keep it no matter what, I guess. But I still would much rather Raw be a two-hour show. And believe me, I don't think Daniel Bryan would just be, a job guy or a mid-carder for life if Raw went back to 2 hours. So his matches are 12 minutes instead of 20. I could live with that, just because I think overall, Raw being shorter would help the show overall. The show would not be... It wouldn't feel as long and as drawn out. You wouldn't be looking at your watch as much. So I think he would have gotten over just fine without it. Tejas writes in, Big E Langston's theme has the lyrics, I need five, but he doesn't win with a five count, so what is the point of the song? Also, do you think Curtis Axel pairing up with Zeb Coulter would have been a good idea? He is from the U.S., so that makes sense. Would Cesaro and Paul Heyman have worked instead? The real American thing for him makes little sense. Well, first, the Langston stuff is bizarre to me. You know, he's a babyface with the five-count gimmick on NXT, or at least he was. I don't know if he's on NXT anymore. I haven't seen him in a while. And on NXT, you know, as a babyface with the five-count gimmick, he was very over. And here, he still has the music, but he's a heel, and he doesn't use the gimmick. So I assume they're just waiting until he goes babyface on the main roster, which he will sooner rather than later. And at that point, I think we'll see him using the five-count deal, so I'm not too worried about that. Cesaro and Heyman, I think, would have worked great. I mean, it's nice that they're trying to use Heyman as a way to give Axel the rub, but Cesaro is ready to be a star now, not 3 years from now. If the only thing missing to them was a personality or promo ability for Antonio Cesaro, then why not let Heyman do all the talking for him and start pushing him as a top guy? Maybe not the tippy-top, but higher than he's slotted now. I mean, between Lesnar's freaky strength and Cesaro's freaky strength, Heyman would have, legitimately, two of the scariest, toughest dudes on the roster. You know, and the big benefit I saw in putting Cesaro with Coulter was that it would get him some TV time after he was buried for all those weeks, so I was all in favor of it. But I agree, absolutely. Paul Heyman and Antonio Cesaro together would have been gold. Omar writes in, how did the Dudley boys lose their name to the WWE machine? Very simple. Dudleys left WWE thinking they had retained the rights to their name because Paul Heyman told them they did when they left ECW. He had told them that it was kind of his way of giving back to them for all their hard work, that, you know, if they ever left WWF, they would be able to still use their names. The only problem is Heyman never filed whatever paperwork needed to be filed to sign the rights over to them. And I think what happened is when WWE snatched up all of ECW's assets in bankruptcy, the Dudley's likenesses were part of the deal. I guess there was some lingering bad blood when they left WWE, and Vince said, we own the name, we're not going to let you guys use it. That's it, very simple. Robert asks, who would you say has been the most successful NXT member from the original NXT show? From NXT Season 1, the most successful guy has been Ryback, Skip Sheffield, for the simple fact that he's challenged for the WWE Championship multiple times in the main event on pay-per-view. He wrestled CM Punk in the main event last year at Hell in a Cell. He was the last one in there with John Cena in the Royal Rumble this year. He wrestled Cena in two straight pay-per-view main events for the title. So even though they've killed the guy dead with all those losses, facts are facts, he's been more successful. Daniel Bryan is about to overtake him as the most successful member because the match with Cena at SummerSlam is going to be his first of hopefully many pay-per-view main events to come, but it just hasn't happened yet. I mean, he's been a World Heavyweight Champion, Ryback hasn't, but the World Heavyweight title means dick. It means nothing. It means nothing. And then he lost it in 18 seconds. Those title matches that Bryan had last year with CM Punk, that was for the WWE title. They were on pay-per-view, but they weren't even real main events. John Cena was still headlining those shows. So Bryan is going to be the most successful. He will go down as the most successful, but right now it's still Ryback. And Wade Barrett is pulling up the rear in third. RJ from the Bronx. I discovered your show through TV Tracks, then realized they were only short clips, so I decided to Google you. And glory behold, I found heaven in your podcast. I have two questions for you. If a wrestler botched a move and killed his opponent, could he be convicted of murder? Also, do you think there will ever be a black WWE champion? On your first question, it would depend on the circumstances. But sure, I mean, if they could prove that one wrestler intentionally killed the other or was negligent in executing a move that resulted in that person's death, I'd imagine they could file manslaughter charges at the very least. If it's an accident, I doubt there's anything that could really be done. I mean, maybe the promoter or the company could get into trouble if they contributed in some way to, you know, unsafe working conditions. There have been instances of this. The Great Khali is a great example. He killed another wrestler when both of them were in training camp, or at least he contributed to his death. I think the wrestler who died may have had some pre-existing condition that he either didn't know about or didn't disclose that led to his death after Khali dropped him. I think it was on a flapjack. But Khali didn't do it on purpose. So that's one example of a situation, I think, kind of what you're referring to. And yes, I do think there will be a WWE champion someday who's black. I mean, we've already had one in The Rock. He's part black. But I know that doesn't please everybody. The Rock isn't black enough, apparently, for some people. So they don't count him. I still believe that had he not quit the company, Bobby Lashley would have gone on to become the first black WWE champion. They loved how big he was. They were pushing him to the moon. They put him into the biggest drawing match in WrestleMania history, that Battle of the Billionaires match at WrestleMania 23. I'm pretty sure he would have been the guy. He never would have been, again, the top guy like John Cena is the top guy. But I definitely think at some point he would have been the first guy to hold that WWE title. Lastly here, Rayvon from New York City. Was there legit heat between Tony Atlas and Bruiser Brody? The reason I ask is because years ago I remember watching a shoot interview with Tony Atlas and he said Brody would not book him in the Ultimate Warrior when they used to work in Texas. Whatever happened to the wrestler who murdered Brody? Why do you think Tony Atlas did not testify against the man who murdered him? You know, oddly enough, someone else also emailed me this week with almost the exact questions that you asked about Atlas and Brody. Every time I think about the Bruiser Brody situation, it just makes me so angry. The fact that this man was murdered in cold blood, and the guy who killed him not only continues to walk free, he was continuously employed and still had a job in wrestling. It just makes me sick. And shame on all the people who worked with him. I mean, I guess in the end it all comes down to money. You know, you gotta work. But for those who don't know the story, we just passed the 25-year anniversary of Bruiser Brody's death down in Puerto Rico. I mentioned it as part of the This Week in Wrestling History segment I did on episode 284. Jose Gonzalez, better known as Invader One, stabbed Brody in a shower stall backstage before an event, and he bled to death later on while he was in surgery. Other wrestlers saw it happen. Some of them helped, some of them didn't. Gonzalez was charged in his murder. He argued that he was acting in self-defense, which is laughable. What he did was premeditated, which it's exactly the reason why he and Brody stepped into the shower in the first place. He asked Brody to step into the shower with him so they could talk. But the jury accepted that as a valid excuse, and they acquitted him. Tony Atlas was there that night. He actually had arranged for he, Brody, and Dutch Mantel to get a lift to the arena, so they all rode together. Atlas and Brody, as best as I can tell, they did have some issues, so there may have been some heat there. But that night, whatever heat they may have had just evaporated after Brody got stabbed. And to hear Mantel, you know, Zeb Coulter, as it were, to hear Coulter tell the story, he saw Tony Atlas single-handedly try to carry Bruiser Brody up a small flight of stairs to help get him into an ambulance. Because that's how big he was. Nobody else could do it. He was so gigantic. He was laying on the ground in that shower for over half an hour before the paramedics arrived. Atlas went to the hospital with him. Atlas went back to the arena to talk to the cops. He was freaking out at them because they didn't understand English, so they were trying to find another wrestler who could translate for him. He finally found someone, but the cops didn't seem to care. Invader had already returned to the locker room after disappearing for a while. He changed his shirt. The murder weapon was missing. It was like nothing had ever happened. And as far as why Atlas never testified, the main reason was that the people who lived in the U.S. who got subpoenaed to testify at Invader's trial in Puerto Rico, they didn't get those notices in the mail until after the trial date. So Mantel had the same thing happen to him. His subpoena was dated in early January, I think it was, but it wasn't mailed for another 10 days. So by the time he opened the envelope, the trial had literally ended the day before. He already knew the verdict when he opened the subpoena. I think the same thing may have happened to Atlas. He may have also been afraid of retaliation against him if he testified. You know, whatever the case, the whole thing stinks. You know, it's obvious they were protecting this guy. And Carlos Colon, who was running the promotion at the time, still a big fixture down in Puerto Rico, he continued to use Invader after the murder. What a piece of shit this guy is. He actually did an angle earlier this year, on TV down there that I read about, where he was going to, you know, quote, come out of retirement to beat up Invader for what he did 25 years ago. What he did. Without actually mentioning the murder, of course. And he said how, you know, he helped him out at the time, but now he was going to give him what he deserves. 60-something-year-old Invader, in there with 60-something-year-old Carlos Colon, wrestling each other. All based around turning the Brody murder into an angle. I mean, you could point to a lot of shit that wrestling promoters have done over the years, some pretty low things. Colon is hardly the only one. He's still a piece of shit.
History has been made here!
This week in wrestling history, 33 years ago, on August 9th, 1980, WWF held its Showdown at Shea event at Shea Stadium in New York, the now former home of the New York Mets. On this show, Andre the Giant beat a heel Hulk Hogan, and Bruno Sammartino defeated Larry Zbysko in a steel cage match. Bob Backlund and Pedro Morales also beat the Wild Samoans to win the WWF Tag Team Championship, but they were forced to vacate the belts because Backlund was already the WWF champion at the time. Now, my question would be, why was he even allowed to compete in the match? If there was a chance he might win, he shouldn't have been allowed to compete. So that was 33 years ago this week. 15 years ago this week, August 8th, 1998, WCW held its Road Wild pay-per-view from Sturgis, South Dakota. Eric Bischoff, big motorcycle buff that he is, decided it would be a good idea to have a pay-per-view event each year at the annual Sturgis Motorcycle Rally. Just a sea of bikers, no tickets for sale, which meant no live gate for these shows, and motorcycle engines blasting nonstop throughout the night. This show came 1 month after Bill Goldberg beat Hollywood Hogan on Nitro to win the WCW World Heavyweight title. Some would say the crowning moment of the WCW boom period, perhaps in company history. That was when Goldberg became the man. So what was the man doing on this show, you might ask? Who was he headlining against for the title? Maybe a rematch with Hogan? Ah, don't be silly. He was stuck in a 9-man battle royal, second from the top, which at least he won, thankfully. Now, you see, the real main event was a tag team match pitting Hulk Hogan and Eric Bischoff against Diamond Dallas Page and Jay Leno. Yes, that Jay Leno, host of The Tonight Show. Not to be mistaken with legendary wrestler Jay Leno, who, in fact, never existed. Not only did WCW promote a pay-per-view with Jay Leno in its main event, he actually won the match. Kevin Eubanks, his band leader on the show at that time, gave Bischoff a diamond cutter, which allowed Leno to score the pinfall for his team. How WCW survived another 2.5 years is a mystery to me. Really, they had far bigger problems than just putting Jay Leno in a pay-per-view match, and I think he did donate all the money he got for the gig to charity, but so did David Arquette. That doesn't make it right. 14 years ago this week, August 9th, 1999, Y2J, Chris Jericho, made his long-anticipated WWE debut on Monday Night Raw in what is still one of the top two debuts in WWE history, the other being Kane. For weeks, they aired these Countdown to the Millennium vignettes on TV, teasing something big was going to happen on that show. When Jericho's name flashed across the Titantron, without people even laying their eyes on him, he got a monster pop from the crowd, who in theory had never seen him before and shouldn't know who he is. But back then, wrestling was so hot, most people knew him from WCW. I doubt that, for example, if AJ Styles or Samoa Joe jumped from TNA to WWE today and he, you know, had a similar debut, they would get anywhere close to the kind of reaction Jericho got here. He interrupted The Rock during his in-ring promo, which is not bad for your first night in. There was a lot of hope that first night, especially him interacting with one of the biggest stars in the company, but they quickly dropped the ball with him. They put him in a feud with China for the Intercontinental title. He even had to put her over on pay-per-view in their first meeting. Jericho talks about all this in his second book. That book covers all the WWE stuff. He wasn't happy about working with China. He even came close to being fired a few times. But in the end, he would go on to become the man with the most Intercontinental title reigns, 9 in total, and the first ever undisputed champion, beating Rock and Steve Austin in the same night at Vengeance 2001. Unlike CM Punk, he actually has a WrestleMania main event under his belt. He wrestled Triple H in 2002 in the final match, even though we all know Rock vs. Hogan was the real main event on that show. He's won tons of other titles. He comes back to help put over younger talent all the time these days. He's always giving back to the business. He'll be a first ballot Hall of Famer for sure. So I think things turned out pretty well for Chris Jericho. I had one of our listeners, Alex from Chicago, right into me. He wanted to know my thoughts on two big milestones in Jericho's career: the title win that never happened against Triple H in 2000 and the undisputed title win. That whole scenario on Raw in 2000, which was actually the go-home show to the Backlash pay-per-view, I think it might have been the go-home show, that was one of the greatest pieces of TV I've ever seen in the history of Raw. I don't remember where I ranked it on my top 30 Raw moments list from episode 228. It had to be pretty high on the list, though, because it's one of my favorite moments. You know, Triple H is the champion. Jericho comes out. He and Triple H are going to have a match. He convinces Triple H to put the title on the line. They have a pretty good match, actually. It was actually a really good match. And Jericho gets the win after Earl Hebner fast counts Triple H, because there were some issues going on at the time with the whole McMahon-Helmsley regime and referee Earl Hebner. So they had already been building that on the side. Triple H had shoved down Hebner, who came out to replace the other referee who had been knocked out. And so when Triple H shoved him down, Jericho nailed Triple H. Hebner fast counted him. Place went nuts. I'll never forget it. It was in State College, Pennsylvania. I still remember there was a guy in one of the front rows wearing like a white sport coat or something. I still have this burned in my brain. People went nuts. The APA was at ringside. They were Jericho's insurance for the match. So Earl ran away. Triple H went to go after him, but Farouk and Bradshaw blocked his path. Lillian Garcia made the announcement, new champion. It was a great, great moment. And even though after commercial they took the title right off him, and it's not even like he was a former champion and they stripped him of it. The whole thing was he never won the title. It never happened. Just pretend like, you know, everything's cool. Triple H is still the champion, uninterrupted. But it helped get Jericho over in kind of a weird way, even though they took the belt right off him. It did help kind of get him in people's eyes in this esteem as more of a main event guy. So that's one of my all-time favorite Raw moments. I thought that was just that first half hour of Monday Night Raw that week. And that was when Raw was only 2 hours long. You know, now they got 3 hours. They throw shit at a wall just to see if it sticks. We get meaningless matches every single week just to fill time. They dedicated something like half an hour, maybe a little bit more, of that two-hour show to this whole angle. And it was totally worth it. It was great TV. As far as the Undisputed title run is concerned, I mean, obviously we know the score. Jericho was never positioned to be the top guy. It was nice they gave him two belts. I think Jericho, maybe in his book or something, I remember him joking about how he walked around for months until WrestleMania with two belts. He had the WWE title, he had the World Heavyweight title, and it wasn't until after Triple H beat him at WrestleMania that they finally, you know, debuted this brand new looking championship belt, the Undisputed belt. So I think I've heard Jericho joke about that before. But anyway, it is what it is. It's something he can hang his hat on. It was a funny thing for his character when he was a heel to always point to. I'm the only one to say they beat Stone Cold and The Rock in the same night. That's all well and good. It's a fun talking point for the character. In the end, did it really mean all that much? Not really. I mean, you're only as good as your book. Was he really ever booked to be the man? Nah, not really. And then the NWO came in and he didn't stand a chance because all the focus was going to be on Hogan, Hall, and Nash. So, not as impressed by the Undisputed title stuff. I was actually more impressed by the title win that they claim never happened. 3 years ago this week, on August 8th, 2010, WWE signed Tyler Black, who at the time was the reigning Ring of Honor champion, to a developmental deal. After that, he would walk around saying that he was going to take the ROH title with him to WWE, but he lost the title to Roderick Strong at the following month's event in his final appearance for the promotion. Supposedly, he also had been offered a TNA contract, but it was Evan Bourne who ultimately convinced him to sign with WWE. Dodged a bullet there. As Seth Rollins, he became the first ever NXT champion. He made his debut on the main roster as part of The Shield at Survivor Series last year. He's now one half of the reigning tag team champions with Roman Reigns, and has all the tools to be a future world champion, as do all the members of The Shield. And finally, it was 1 year ago this week, on August 6, 2012, on Monday Night Raw, General Manager AJ Lee made a main event of John Cena versus Daniel Bryan. Boy, that sounds familiar, doesn't it? This was part of her plan to insert each member of the SummerSlam main event into a match. Big Show and CM Punk were seen as opponents at the pay-per-view last year, who also had matches on the show. Cena put Bryan in the STF. Bryan managed to counter that into a no-lock. Cena countered that, got Bryan up for an attitude adjustment, and scored the pinfall. I, for one, am hoping for a very different outcome in their upcoming match. And that's this week in wrestling history. I want to also point out that Art Donovan died last Sunday. It was actually right after I posted last week's show. At the age of 88, I guess he had been sick for a while. He had been under hospice care. Art Donovan, the big NFL player from back in the day, who had a very infamous stint as an announcer at the 1994 King of the Ring. He was on commentary with Gorilla Monsoon and the Macho Man Randy Savage. And if you want to hear more of Art Donovan and why he is often regarded as the worst announcer in WWE history, you can go back and check out my King of the Ring edition of The Sound Off. I believe it was episode 278. I actually have audio from Art Donovan that night. And he was pretty terrible. I guess kind of, sort of, in a lovable old grandpa kind of way, but still very terrible. But very sad to hear that Art Donovan has passed away. I think I even made a comment on the show. I couldn't believe that he was still alive. I said Monsoon is dead, Savage is dead, and yet Art Donovan was still alive. And now he's dead too. I hope I didn't jinx the old guy. If you have questions for the mailbag, you can email them to me at thesolomonster@gmail.com. That includes your audio questions. Please follow me on Twitter as well. We just broke 2,600 followers, so we're marching up to 2,700 next. You can follow me at Solomonster. Facebook.com/thesolomonster. Send me a friend request. I will get you approved, and you can participate in all the fun stuff going on Facebook. We have a discussion group separate and apart as well from our Facebook profile. If you type in Solomonster Sounds Off, it is a group. We have well over 350 members. Again, you have to apply for membership. But if you want to find the group on there and apply, there's a lot of great discussion that goes on in there as well. And I think a lot of people aren't aware of the group, so I just want to point that out every now and then. And you can subscribe to this show in iTunes. You can listen to us each and every single week on Stitcher Radio. We are climbing the sports rankings on Stitcher thanks to you guys. So you can certainly download the traditional way if you want to or subscribe in iTunes. But if you also listen to us in Stitcher, you are supporting the show. So I thank you for that. And you can make a PayPal donation on thesolemonster.com. So I think that covers all the important stuff. I want to thank each and every one of you for tuning in this week. We will be back next weekend for episode 288, where I will have my SummerSlam predictions. And as I pointed out on Twitter, I only realized this yesterday. I was thinking about it. If we don't miss a show between now and November, as things currently stand, when we hit episode 300 of the Sound Off, episode 300 is currently slated to fall exactly on the 6-year anniversary of the Sound Off. So everything has to kind of go right between now and then. No missed shows, no bonus shows. But if all goes according to plan, that's a pretty cool milestone right there. So something to look forward to. Until next week, be well, stay safe, enjoy all the wrestling this week. There's certainly no shortage of it. And we will be right back here for more of the Sound Off next time. Take care, guys.
You've been listening to the Solomonster Sounds Off, giving you the good. The bad.
Raw is now 3 hours every Monday at 8.
And the ugly.
Hello. Why does Jerry Lawler insist on telling us that we are just getting started? What the fuck have I been watching for the past 2 hours?
Well, mostly the good.
I don't want to K-fab you.
You're going to K-fab me?
Solar Monster Sounds Off.
Since 2007 on thesolomonster.com, iTunes, and Stitcher Radio, The Solar Monster Sounds Off.